who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Today, we're celebrating Labor Day Week 2021. My guests are Rick Gallo, president of the Kenosha County AFL-CIO Central Labor Council, and Scott Sharp, president of the Racine AFL-CIO Council. Good morning to you both.
Good morning,
Len. Good morning, Len.
A happy Labor Day week to you both. My guests represent two of the nearly 500 state and local labor councils of the AFL-CIO, which are at the heart of the labor movement, according to their websites. The councils are democratically elected bodies. They are dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and at the local levels. They mobilize their members and their community partners to advocate for social and economic justice. Their websites also say that they strive to vanquish oppression, make our communities better for all people, regardless of race, color, gender, religion, age, sexual orientation, or ethnic or national origin. Membership is listed as 56 unions comprising 12.5 million members, and I'm privileged to be a part of one of them and was represented in the state of Illinois when I worked for the university system there, and I'm still represented by them. So, gentlemen, let's dive right in and talk about the annual local Labor Day celebrations, which I enjoy so much every year. I, of course, like to hear the politicians, but even more the great food, and to visit with so many community friends that I always see at the Labor Fests. Well, we missed the Labor Fests this year and last. Could you tell us what your hopes are for Labor Day 2022? And perhaps share with us what public activities your councils have undertaken recently or are planning for the next few months?
Well, Rick, I'll let you go first, but first of all, I'd like to say happy Labor Day to Len.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Rick, what do you what do you have at the top of your mind, sir?
Well, most of our public activities have in large part been curtailed, mostly due to COVID. We have been conducting the business of the Kenosha Central Labor Council, mostly via Zoom on a month-to-month basis. Over the next few months, of course, we hope that the pandemic will be somewhat curtailed via vaccinations and we can start to get much more back to normal. We've continued to write letters and contact state and national legislators concerning a variety of issues. And, so we're hoping that things can get somewhat back to normal. And with regard to Labor Fest, it was a difficult decision for us to cancel, even more so this year because things were seemingly starting to open up. But we looked at all of the recommendations that were given to us to hold a COVID safe event, and we just didn't feel that we were able to comply with many of them. And looking at the numbers of hospital beds and that are being utilized for COVID patients, I don't think it was the wrong decision to cancel. I think it was the right thing to do. Sometimes doing the right thing isn't always the easy decision, but so we're hopeful that Labor Day 2022, things will be enough back to normal that we can resume our Labor Fest celebrations in the same manner that we have historically done so, because Len, we miss it as much as you do.
Well, I think you made the right decision, folks. I really applaud what you did. Leadership means that you have to do things that are sometimes unpopular and difficult. And if you don't want to do that, then you ought not to be a leader. And I wish more people understood that concept, frankly. That's just my personal opinion. So I think you've done exactly the right thing. And I'm proud of you for doing that. What would you like to add, Scott? You're from the Racine Group.
Yes, Len, thank you for having us on. And I'd just like to add, as what Rick has stated, is we again had to make the hard decision and cancel for our second year our event that's held out at Franksville Park. And we had to take into account canceling Labor Fest again this year. And it was a hard decision. And looking forward to what we plan on doing this year. Labor Fest is a tradition, and what we do is we celebrate what labor has brought to the community. And a lot of people ask what the AFL-CIO is going to do again. And people always ask us, what does the AFL-CIO stand for? And that stands for the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations. And we've worked tirelessly to improve the lives of working people through democracy. And we represent, as you stated, 56 national and international labor unions. And we represent 12.5 million working men and women. And we work tirelessly for decent paychecks, benefits, safe jobs, dignity, and equal opportunities for everybody we represent. And we'll continue to do that. And I'm sure we'll talk later about the PRO Act and how important it is that we pass that legislation. And I can talk about how important that would be for Wisconsin as I was a public employee and how that affected us here in the state of Wisconsin and what Act 10 and 32 did to public employees, not only for government employees, but for the teachers of the state. So we'll continue to organize, we'll continue to educate, and we'll continue to train people on the effects of COVID-19 and the importance of keeping our employees trained and safe and continue to help our members the best we can through this trying time.
The newspaper published at the beginning of the week that according to data collected by the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, union density in Wisconsin has dropped from 34% in 1964 to 8.8% in 2020. Let me repeat that. 34% union membership in 1964 and 8.8% in 2020. And that's 2.1% lower than the national average. Now, I unfortunately have lived so long that I can remember when times were better. And those were times were when the labor movement was very strong in Kenosha, in the 50s and the 60s. I'm in my mid-70s now. We didn't have anywhere near the level of poverty and economic insecurity and food insecurity that we have today. And I think that's really significant, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, gentlemen. But, you know, before we go too much further, I'd like to ask you about AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, who died recently, almost just over exactly a month ago on August 5th. Rick and Scott, could you talk a little bit about Mr. Trumka? He was quite a figure in the labor movement during our lifetimes, wasn't he?
Absolutely, he was. Scott, you want to go first or shall I?
It's up to you. Do you want to go first or shall I? I
guess
I can go first. And I had the opportunity of meeting President Trumka back when he was actually before he became president. I met him down in Kenosha. We had a meeting down at the Labor Temple in Kenosha when we were having meetings on reorganizing central labor councils. And he was as fiery back then as he was as president of the AFL-CIO. Again, I had the opportunity of working with him when he came to Wisconsin, and I brought up before about Act 10 and Act 32 when he was back in Wisconsin, and he, as you stated, passed away on August 5th at the young age of 72, because, as you stated, Len, we're all getting older. I'm hitting 64, so I, like you, have seen the years of decline in the labor movement. And when Scott Walker passed Act 10 and 32 that took away collective bargaining rights for public employees, he was here to lead the fight with us against taking collective bargaining rights away from teachers and public employees. He was here to stand arm in arm with us up in Madison. And he was a relentless champion of workers' rights, worker safeties. He was a center for trade democracy. And he was, besides that, he found time to be a devoted father, grandfather, husband. He was there for us when we needed him. And it's a sad passing in time, but we all have to stand up and continue to fight the fight that Richard Trumka has showed us how to do, and continue to, you know, show us the way that Brother Trumka showed us how to fight. And with that, I'll let my brother show us, you know, how to fight the good fight.
Rick, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I also had the opportunity to hear Rich Trumka speak on a number of occasions, and he was always a very dynamic speaker. He came across as being somewhat soft-spoken, but the gravity of some of the major issues were not lost on him, and he would aptly convey his feelings very bluntly. One of the things that struck me about Richie Trumka is that he would hold weekly meetings with the various central labor councils and state federations across the country. And so, you know, we could get on virtually any Wednesday afternoon and get direct input and discourse with the president of the organization. And I think that he treated us pretty much as true partners in the infrastructure of the AFL-CIO. So I always appreciated that. And I know that at the time of his death, he was with his grandchildren on a camping trip. And so, you know, it's somewhat disheartening that he went that way, but at the same time, it's kind of comforting to know that he was doing things that he truly enjoyed. And one of the things that always impressed me about him is he had a reputation for telling it to your face exactly the way it is. He didn't mince words. You knew where you stood with Richie Trumka.
Yes, that's certainly true. I really appreciate your taking time to tell us some of your personal stories about Mr. Trumka. Do you fellows have any concern about the leadership of the AFL-CIO at the national level with his passing, or do you feel that the succession plan is well in hand and that you have faith in the process?
No, I think we have great faith in the succession, and I would just like to state that President Liz Shula, who happens to be the first woman to lead the national AFL-CIO Federation of Workers, stood side by side with President Trumka for the last 12 years. And she is a member of the IBEW. And President Trumka always believed in diverse leadership. And she has been there side by side with him, fighting the battles right along with him. And no, I have complete belief in her leadership, and she's ready to lead us through the next decade and beyond. So no, I have no doubt at all in her leadership.
What about you, President Gallo?
I can echo Scott's words, Len. I think that Liz is brings vast experience to the table. She was when she was first elected to the executive board of the AFL-CIO, she was the youngest woman ever on the executive board at the time, and that was back in 2009. So I think that Liz has a pretty good pulse on the of the organization, and also has a very broad understanding of the issues that face organized labor and that face the country in terms of budget and laws and, you know, the whole array of things that come into play versus workers' lives. And so I have no doubt that we are in very capable hands in Liz Shuler's leadership.
Yes, I think you've both made a point of the walking the walk of diversity and equity and inclusion that the AFL-CIO has championed at virtually every level that I'm aware of, and it has been a leader in the fight for marginalized and oppressed peoples. And that's something for the movement to be very, very proud of. It's one thing to talk the talk. It's another thing to actually fight for those rights and be out front. And the labor movement has been. I'd like to just digress here for a moment and talk a little bit about why the labor movement is important. My guests this morning on Community Matters are the presidents of the labor councils, the central labor councils of Racine and Kenosha. Rick Gallo is the president of the Kenosha AFL-CIO Central Labor Council, and Scott Sharp is the president of the Racine AFL-CIO Council. You know, a lot of the things we take for granted, like something like the 5-day work week or an 8-hour day and being able to decline overtime and not being treated like you're in involuntary servitude or an indentured servant when you're working for an employer. We take those things for granted today everywhere, but that wasn't the case. And those rights, those privileges, those human rights of justice and dignity were not granted magnanimously by employers who cared deeply about social justice, except in the odd off case. Isn't that correct, Scott?
Yes, it is. And I guess people tend to forget that used to employ children as workers, and people forgot that we had to enact child labor laws in this country, that people used to employ children before they hired adults to work jobs. And unions were the people that brought you vacations and the 40-hour work week and sick days and health insurance. So, I mean, as you look at the pandemic, and that's why people are again looking at unions, and they're looking at people that belong to unions as a way that we are able to organize new jobs and organize new employees, because they see what union members have. And we're now able to have new organizing wins because people are seeing what we have, and that we have, you know, health insurance, and we have greater protections on the job. If you look at some of the tolls that the jobs have taken, if you look at the past with COVID-19 and you look at the workers that were in the meat industry, like you saw the effects of COVID-19 when they were working in the chicken industry, in the pork industry, that there weren't health and safety regulations, and not to mention, and I won't mention the names of the various employers, but you saw the effects in North and South Dakota of the employees that were coming down with COVID-19 and the deaths that were affected. You wonder why those people now want to belong to a union, because there wasn't any health and safety regulations in place. So now that's a great way of people organizing those employees. So that's why there's an increase in organizing going on today.
Thank you, President Sharp. President Gallo, you have a take on this?
I do. I think that people tend to underestimate how much unions have brought to the table and what type of things that we have supported over the last 50 to 100 years that, very important things. And these weren't fights that we simply waved a magic wand and lo and behold, now we have an 8-hour work day or we have a 40-hour work week. People actually in Wisconsin lost their lives protesting for the 40-hour work week. Up in Milwaukee, where a bunch of company, there was a large-scale strike and protest for in support of the 40-hour work week, and company private police, if you will, opened fire and shot and killed a number of people that were simply protesting in favor of the 40-hour work week. So these are things that people not only bled for, but put a great deal of work into. And there's so many things, you know, some of the things we've already mentioned, but let me throw a couple other ones out there. The Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA. You know, people say, oh, employers will do the right thing. They wouldn't put their workers in harm's way. But the facts are that they did. It was always about the bottom line for companies. You know, they weren't interested in putting guards on machines that could maim or kill people because guards cost money. You know, so they would save that money. And where did it go? You know, in the pockets of the managers and owners and big business. You know, and that whole thing. So, you know, that's just a sliver of some of the things that unions supported, not to mention Social Security, minimum wage increases, unemployment insurance, workplace standards. I mean, we just went through or are still in the throes of a pandemic with COVID. And, you know, think about what would happen if we didn't have unions that could at least bring to the table issues of personal protective equipment. You know, would you really want to put the hospital employees at risk without masks or shields or anything to protect them in treating COVID patients? I think, you know, most people, the answer would be unequivocally no. But, you know, sadly, we have over time had to go to the mat on some of these issues, and unions were there to do that. And I certainly, you know, thank my lucky stars that I was involved in a union, because we looked at things that went on with the employer and how they would ignore contract provisions. And that was with a union. My God, if they didn't have one, I hesitate to think how different life would be on a daily basis for workers.
You both have done a really good job of pointing out that even for those workers who were not organized, who were not represented by a union, they had a floor established in the marketplace of labor that forced other companies to compete and give benefits that they might not otherwise have. But let's talk for a moment about something as simple but as pivotal as the right to organize. Now, the manufacturers have an organization. Here's one. They have a very powerful one here in the state of Wisconsin. The legislators of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, they organize. Lawyers organize. Doctors organize. But when it comes to people, working people like the rest of us, there are people who say that we should not have the right to have an equal footing. We should not have a right to organize, that we have to all bargain individually with our employer, which of course means we have zero power, because there is an utterly ridiculous power imbalance between myself or yourself, Scott, Rick, as individuals, and the monster, probably international companies, that we're working for. Let's talk a little bit about the right to organize and what that's about, because people have traditionally in this nation, it's sort of a bedrock of this nation. Tocqueville pointed out that people organize to get things done, but when it comes to workers organizing to ask for a better life, somehow that gets portrayed as an evil.
Yeah. Yes, it does. I would say, Len, that, you know, people really need to take a serious look at history and look at why unions formed in the first place, and you know, the atrocities that people were enduring to the point where they basically couldn't take it anymore and sought, you know, some mechanism to fight back against these actions. And so, you know, they formed unions and they were able to collectively bargain. And a lot of people don't realize that the National Labor Relations Act guarantees workers the right to organize. The problem is that we have, again, organized groups that oppose these rights. And so there are leading national and even in Wisconsin law firms that specialize in union avoidance and trying to defeat union elections and that sort of thing. So when people, even with that guaranteed right under federal law to organize, the law in reality doesn't work for the people as well as it was intended to do.
I've seen with my own eyes and ears how employers will do everything possible to influence you to vote against unionization by threatening your job.
Yes. There's harassment, there's intimidation, there's captive meetings. You know, as soon as you sign up or make an indication that you want to form a union, an election needs to take place. And as they're going through that process, they have captive meetings where they bombard the employees unfairly with basically fake propaganda. Information. People don't realize, you know, the reality of the situation. And this is in today's day and age. Not all that long ago, we attempted to organize a bunch of truck drivers that haul the mail. I worked for the Postal Service and the Postal Workers Union, and we were going to organize guys that were contract drivers for the mail. In the mailing industry, that is a several billion with a B dollar industry just for the contracting out part of it. And we tried to do that, and we had a meeting outside of a hotel, and the company vice president came and parked his Cadillac outside the front door of the hotel. And we had, I think there were 70 or 80 truck drivers working out of that terminal, and only one had enough moxie to come into the meeting and talk with us. And he basically told us, yeah, the vice president's sitting out there and all the other guys are intimidated and won't come in and even hear what you have to say. So that even goes on in today's atmosphere. So, you know, think about how it was in the organizing drives back in the 30s, 40s and 50s, where, you know, people would have their heads cracked or be beaten up or, you know, set upon to dissuade them from organizing. And I think that's a real shame.
It's just a little more sophisticated today, isn't it?
Oh,
Scott,
yes.
What do you think? You know, you guys have been very involved with something called the PRO Act. You've been very involved with fighting Act 10, which was unfortunately a losing battle. This is all wrapped up in that. Do you want to talk about, introduce us to that subject, please?
Sure, and that's why we're out supporting the passage of the PRO Act, and that gives the ability to be able to collect a bargain and to collect a bargain in your first contract, and it puts in protections, as you two just discussed, the freedom to go in and organize and to have protections against those union-busting law firms, so you don't have to sit into those meetings that they're trying to stop you from organizing. So you can go in there and have those free organizing drives, and you can have those protections under the PRO Act. Also, people don't know that it's been passed through Congress, and we're just trying to get it passed through the Senate. And it's going to be a hard uphill battle, and we would ask everybody that's listening to call your senator on the passage of the PRO Act. It's going to be a hard battle. As you know, there's a filibuster rule that's in place in the Senate that you have to have 60 votes to pass the PRO Act. I would just go on to say that right now you can still get organizing drives passed. And in the state of Wisconsin, we still have the state AFL-CIO and our president, Stephanie Bloomingfield, who happens to be the first woman president of the state AFL-CIO. And she is a wonderful leader. She came from the Wisconsin Federations of Nurses, and she's done a great job as, again, as the first president of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO. And she was an organizing, and she has done a great job leading our organization through organizing wins, and we've had several of those wins, you know, through the hard way. Going back to Act 10, as a public employee, I worked for the city of Racine for 37 years. I was on both sides of collective bargaining, and when Act 10 came into effect, we lost collective bargaining. The only thing we could bargain for was wages, and that was just through the cost of living. So basically, you were only able to bargain was for 0.8% of wages. So basically, when you stated those lost of union jobs, you basically lost those jobs were public employees that were people that worked for government and teachers. Those were the huge jobs, the sucking sound of public employees being lost through Act 10 and 32. You had to reorganize those jobs every year through the National Labor Relations Board and through the WERC. You had to hold elections every year at a huge cost and a huge organizing drive every year. So that's why we've seen a decline in union membership and density in the state of Wisconsin. So that's why we had to pass the PRO Act, so then again can give people the ability to organize without the restraints that we're currently under through Act 10 and Act 32 in the state of Wisconsin and nationally.
Yeah, it tickles me that nobody's saying that the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers and Commerce needs to disband or reorganize every year or get special privileges in order and make special requests in order to have a membership and do their aggressive lobbying and arm twisting of legislators. But when ordinary Janes and Joes try to do it, somehow it becomes an evil thing. Rick, what's your response to the PRO Act and the associated problems of organizing that have been caused by the court rulings and laws in the last couple of decades?
Well, thanks for the question, Len. Scott already mentioned that the PRO Act has passed the House of Representatives, and we're hoping that, you know, it can get through the Senate. President Biden has indicated that he would absolutely sign it, and he's supporting passage of the PRO Act. But you know, the National Labor Relations Act was really supposed to protect the rights of workers to organize, but there are so many shortcomings in the current law and what has proven where they find loopholes that they can avoid actual implementation of the law. So, like, employers basically can fire pro-union workers with no real consequences. And the PRO Act would establish civil penalties for employers who violate workers' rights. And it actually puts an individual liability on corporate officials so that they can't skate the law, that they have to follow what the intent of the National Labor Relations Act really is. And, you know, in every union election, there seems to be some kind of interference with the election process. Or the election is stalled where it buys more time to give the company time to lobby against and campaign against unionization. And the PRO Act would basically stop that by restoring changes in the election process and making clear that the decision over bargaining units are to be made by the workers and the NLRB and not manipulated by employers. As far as the communications where employers have the captive audience meetings that I had talked about earlier, where workers hear only anti-union messages, the PRO Act would ban captive audience meetings so workers aren't coerced into hearing only the employer's anti-union messages, and it requires employers to allow workers to use company email systems for organizing purposes unless there are compelling business reasons for disallowing it. Where employers currently hire professional union busters to push back, the PRO Act would require a prompt disclosure of union busting activities and closes the loophole that employers now use and with their consultants that evade such reporting. And so I think all of those are very positive things for workers. And then once workers actually do unionize, you know, and they try to get a first contract with the employer, usually the employer continues to resist and drags on the process, is sometimes for many years, to get an initial collective bargaining agreement. And the act requires that they bargain in good faith with the union once the employees have so elected, and they must move forward with negotiating a contract and do so in good faith. So I think, you know, none of that sounds like it's a real radical thought. You know, it seems to me to be a common sense thing that would give the workers a voice in their own destiny. And you know, realistically, you know, the workers aren't out to bankrupt a company or, you know, to do any disservice. If the company prospers, workers that work there prosper as well. And so, you know, it's that thought that a rising tide lifts all boats. And so not only does that help the unionized workers, the non-unionized workers, employers also have to compete with that process, and everybody wins. And I think it's, you know, when you're talking about a win-win situation, it's kind of hard to throw dirt on that.
It bemuses me to see sometimes that the same people who decry forced re-education in, say, communist China or in the old Soviet Union think it's perfectly okay to force propaganda on workers when they're trying to organize a union through compulsory meetings. But be that as it may, you know, the AFL-CIO is more than just the issues we've discussed. And I'd be remiss if I didn't make note of the many issues that your national organization lists on its website as of concern and that they're working for. And those include labor law, better pay and benefits, civil rights, corporate greed, gender equality, global workers' rights, immigration, infrastructure, and workplace health and safety. And there's plenty of subtopics beyond those. If we covered them all, we'd still be talking well into Sunday afternoon instead of ending at noon today, this Saturday. Gentlemen, let's talk a little bit more about the priorities for your organizations and maybe just a nod to the idea of the $15 minimum, national minimum wage that once again the patriotic millionaires have come out in support of. Rick, would you like to lead off on the minimum wage, please?
Sure. With regard to the minimum wage, you know, we would as an AFL-CIO organization, certainly support an increase in the minimum wage. Realistically, the current minimum wage of $7 and what is it, $7.25 has been around for more than a decade, which is unconscionable. But even in Wisconsin, the reality is that many of the service industries, you go in a restaurant and your wait staff typically is making $2 and change per hour, not the $7.25, because there's a, you know, a little provision in Wisconsin law that allows employees who rely on tips to be paid at, I think it's now $2.30 an hour. And so, you know, you look at what the poverty level is, $7 an hour doesn't even come close to getting you out of poverty. So, you know, the minimum wage is actually designed to provide 40 hours, people working 40 hours a week with enough to live on. And $7.25 an hour does not come close to that. You are way below the poverty line with a $7 an hour wage. So, you know, I think that absolutely supporting the minimum wage is one of the things that we need to do. But in terms of priorities for our organization, organizing is one of them. We need to build back our membership base, and passing the PRO Act would certainly help in that regard. Raising the minimum wage would help. Workers, of course, need to be able to put food on the table and a roof over their heads without working two to three jobs each to do that. I would like to see the percentage of unionized workers significantly rebound. It's not unrealistic to think that doubling our numbers is possible in the next decade, which is something that I would certainly like to see. And just as the economy drives the country, including the Midwest region and Southeast Wisconsin, if the jobs and wages are there, that in turn strengthens the economy in general. I want to go back, you know, when we first started the program today, you had mentioned that union numbers as a percentage are down from 30-some percent to about 7%. And I would also like to note just this past week, Gallup released a poll that showed that 66% of people favor unions, and that rises up to 75% of minorities that would favor unionization. And that's a 56-year high, so we have the opportunity to organize.
Wow. I'd like to close to ask you to each sort of a lightning round here of a minute or so each. Each of you, where do you hope the movement will be by 2030, by the end of this decade? Scott, go.
The PRO Act is passed, and we have collective bargaining rights back in the state of Wisconsin for public employees, for teachers, and for government employees. You want further than that? I can go further.
Rick?
$15 minimum wage passed.
Go ahead.
I concur with that, and I hope that we do, especially in the state of Wisconsin, restore some of the rights that were lost under the Walker administration with Act 10 and some of the other things that were done to workers. So that would be a big part of it. I wish I had a proverbial crystal ball. And I could say that unions are back with the kind of clout that we had 30, 40 years ago. I don't know that that'll happen in the next decade, but hopefully in the next two decades. I'd like to see us move in the direction that workers are empowered to do more, to organize and to shape the way that things happen in this country, right from budget to laws to everything, because it all comes down to affecting people's lives. And you know, who better than workers? And put it in the context of the pandemic, most workers, with almost few exceptions, were considered essential and continued to work. So what's the reward for working is you have no rights? I mean, that just makes no sense to me. So I hope that we can absolutely expand for workers and make their work lives and their personal lives better as a result.
Any other quick thoughts from you, Scott?
I would also like to see us have more of control with pro-union elections, that we were able to pass something more along the line in Wisconsin, where we would have more of a split House in Democratic control instead of Republicans in control of both houses, where we have more of a split houses, where we're not, we're so adversarial, where we have more of a democracy in place, and where we can have more things that are done, where we're not so much against each other, and that we're able to pass more things that are good for the state of Wisconsin and its citizens and for labor.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both my guests, Rick Gallo, president of the Kenosha County AFL-CIO Central Labor Council, and Scott Sharp, president of the Racine AFL-CIO Council. For Community Matters, this is Len Iaquinta, urging you to get informed and get involved. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD.